So how do you sense this? Imagine this. The cranial wave is tiny, tiny, tiny. It's very minute. This is a sheet of paper. And see how thin it is? That's 100 microns. The actual movement that I'm feeling, or a practitioner is feeling, is 40 microns, less than half the thickness of this piece of paper. But as your fingers begin to, as you get quieted down and slow down your own cranial wave to almost a meditative state, you can feel that. You can feel that field of energy. You can feel that movement. You can sense where there's trauma, sense where things are fluid. Only after you've stilled yourself and after you've gotten yourself to a meditative state. The cranial wave is about 8 to 14 times, I said, per minute. In a coma, it gets down to about 2, which is not a period of healing. But Tibetan monks and serious cranial sacral workers who have learned to slow down their cranial wave, to go deep within, to become very, very quiet, can slow our wave down to 4 or 3, which instead of being a trauma, is this time of great nurturing and healing. So it takes quite a bit of self-work in order to be able to do this. But it's our thinking, intelligent fingers can feel this. Some of the history of where this came from. In all honesty, the origins of it go back to Neanderthal time, of the laying out of hands, of touching. Your instinct when you get hurt, you rub it, right? There's a natural instinct. When newborns have someone has just given birth, the mother begins to do cranial molding on the head. It's instinctive. It's part of where we've come from, who we are. So it really came from Neanderthal time, the bone setters. And those traditions were passed down in different ways and forms throughout thousands of years. So really 140,000 years we're talking about. So it's not new, although in the Midwest, people's understanding of what cranial sacral work is we fly under the radar. It's a new field for many people just beginning to understand what the work is. Right after the Civil War, there was a doctor, Andrew Taylor Still, in the United States, who was from Missouri, so he was on the side of the South. He went into the Civil War, volunteered, he's a doctor. He came out, but within a short period of time, he had not only lost one wife, his first wife, and a couple of children, but then a few years later, lost 3 of his children to spinal meningitis. And with all his training as a doctor, there was nothing he could do to save them, and went into this period of deep depression and grief. So he was out, the official story, he was out clearing brush, had a headache, laid down on the log. There were some bumps in the log that compressed the back of his head, and his headache left. That's the official story. In the unofficial story, which was written in his journal, and only very few people have been allowed to read his journal, is that he was out clearing brush, had a headache, laid down, went into this euphoric state, and had a vision, was visited by what he describes as 3 Hindus, H-I-N-D-O-O-S, who imparted the history of the world, their philosophy, and the whole practice of bone setting. That's the unofficial story. Within a few years, he took up the banner that was handed to him and started the Kirksville School of Osteopathy. A number of years later, one of his, who will soon become the most prominent student, William Sutherland, had been already in school. It was his senior year. He was walking through the campus, and all of a sudden he was just drawn to this representation in the main hallway of what was called a Beauchamp skull, which is a disarticulated skull, a skull where all the bones were separated in relationship to how they would fit together. And he was just standing there looking at it. He had passed this thing who knows how many times. And all of a sudden he heard his inner ear opened up, and he heard beveled like the gills of a fish to permit an articular motility. So that means for breath, the breath of life, movement. It scared him when he heard this. And he didn't want anybody, he didn't talk to anybody about it. But the idea kept popping back up in his head that the brain moved, that there was movement of the cranial bones. So he graduated, started his practice, and this idea was haunting him. So he started taking apart skulls in private, in hiding. He just didn't let his wife know what's going on. And was able begin to notice the suture lines and how they were this beautiful mechanism for movement. So he started experimenting on himself in privacy. He had, at that time, football helmets were leather, and he started getting all these little doodads and things to try to create different kind of pressures in his own head and then record what those pressures did. So he did this for years. His book, The Cranial Bowl, outlines all these amazing things that he found as far as what pressures in the temporals, what that can do. Pressure in the frontal bone, what that can do to the prefrontal cortex and the functioning of the brain. So he was still keeping this quiet. He was still functioning as an osteopath. But one day he forgot, things were getting busier, and he was like experimenting on himself in between his patients, and he walked out and forgot to take his helmet off. His wife realized what had been happening, and so he began to talk about it. He began to do things, always hold his client, his patient's head. He began to let them be introduced to the work that he was discovering. And he soon became known as someone who was really tremendous with headaches and really good with working with the head, and word got out. So to make a long story short, he developed cranial osteopathy, which was working with the whole cranium, beginning to see how the functioning of the brain and the spine. But it wasn't until later on when he was doing an experiment on himself that he realized, after he stopped all cranial movement in his head, all of a sudden there was this movement in his sacrum, and that the two were part of two poles of the same breath of life, of the same functioning. And this just opened the door. So he started publishing articles and developed a really wonderful work that he died in 1953. A number of years later, so the work sort of fell a bit to the wayside. But in the late 60s...
How old was he when he died?
In his 80s.
In his 80s? Mm-hmm. Did it say how he died?
He told his wife the year before that he wasn't going to be around much longer, and although he was in good health and was still teaching on his deathbed. Yeah.